Today's episode of Motherfucklore was made possible by supporters on Patreon, including Quiva Tiernan and James Murphy, Karamila Mahagrave, Quiva, August James. Through Patreon, listeners are able to support the continued production of the Motherfucklore podcast and allow us to get the resources that we need to continue bringing the show that you love. And we will also be bringing out additional bonus content for our Patreon supporters. You can find out more at Patreon. The link is in our show notes. And now, the show. From the Heads of Podcast Network, but not from Heads of Studios this week, welcome to Motherfucklore, the Quarantine Sessions. I'm Derek O'Shea. Something we've discussed on this podcast a number of times is hybrid Irish identities, the complexity of Irish identity, and our relationship with the diaspora, if that word is even appropriate. And what we haven't had yet is a person from the Irish diaspora in England to actually tell their side of the story. And I just happened this week to have made contact with a PhD student in the University of Newcastle, who is actually doing her research on that very thing. Welcome to Motherfucklore, Niamh Lear.
Hello.
How are you getting on, Niamh?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and thank you very much. I know what the late stages of a PhD are like in terms of stress and panic and all those things. So I'm delighted you've taken some time to come and have a chat with us today.
I mean, it's lovely to have an excuse to not be looking at a Word document, to be perfectly honest.
God, yeah, the amount of procrastinating people do in the late stages of postgraduate research. As Emer Duffy, a regular on this show, would I say, she did so much hoovering when she was finishing her master's.
As we say, my house has never been cleaner.
That's right, you can always tell. when I was writing my first and second book, when I came home, if my wife came home and looked around the house and it was tidy, she said, "You didn't do any writing today, did you?"
My flatmate's the same. She'll come back and there'll be like reorganized bookshelves, and she'd be like, "Have you got a deadline or something?"
Oh God, yeah. I think I briefly tried to color coordinate our bookshelf. Having all the red books in one shelf and all the green ones in another, and yeah, that didn't go down too well.
It's very visually appealing.
I think it is, but then I guess a part of me doesn't like the idea of having a cookbook next to, you know, kind of my New Yorker book of the 40s, and how we're mixing those things. It's hard. You've got to strike a balance between thematic and yeah, I know my wife's law books are all on the law shelf. We don't touch that.
Wise, very wise.
I think so. So Niamh, tell us what your PhD title is, if you may.
Okay, so my working PhD title is Passport Paddy's, Second Generation Irishness in London in Brexit Britain. So that's essentially, it's pretty much what I'm looking at is how people are negotiating and experiencing second and third generation Irish identity within the context of Brexit, because that's kind of an unavoidable reality of the UK right now, unfortunately.
And this is something I suppose that we've discussed before, how Irish identity is shaped partly, but largely in some ways by diaspora aspects, or give a chance to talk about Ireland as a unit in a way. Something we discussed in our episode about the Pogues, and this is something my father used to say, that if the Pogues were actually from Ireland, they'd be from a county or a city. They'd be a Dublin band or a Cork band instead of being an Irish band, and being from London freed them to be that.
Mm-hmm. To be more like representative, I guess.
Exactly. The ability to be just from Ireland in a way, or to actually speak and in that sense is something that is that maybe the diaspora experience makes possible.
Yeah, I think so. I think I feel very proudly from Mayo. but that's mainly my mum doing. But I think, like, as you say, that when I'm speaking to people, it's not like, "Oh, where are you from?" It's like, I'm Irish. Mm-hmm. There's no need to go into the specifics of it, which I guess is kind of nice, because I just say, like, it is like a very Irish thing to be like, "Oh, like, where are you from?" As in, like, which county, which town? Because I probably know someone who knows someone.
I bet that's happened a few times. All right.
So genuinely, I'm not even joking you. I was outside Morrison's in Newcastle.
Mm.
And someone was, he had a petition, something to do with like British imperialism. And I was like, sign me right up for anti-British imperialism. I'm all over that. And we just got chatting and he saw, it was during the Six Nations, I had my rugby jersey on.
Mm.
And I had a clad around my neck and whatever. And he's like, oh, are you from Ireland? And I was like, oh, you know, my mum is. And he's like, whereabouts? And I was like, Mayo. He was like, you're joking. Where in Mayo?
Mm.
And I was like, oh, Swinford. And he was like, no. And his dad went to school with my mum.
Of course he did.
Obviously he did.
Because he just met an Irish person on the street in Newcastle. Of course his father went to school with your mum.
Obviously he went to school with my mum. Like I've been in his family shop multiple times.
What's that?
Small world. It's a very small world in the Irish diaspora, let me tell you.
It certainly is. I mean, if you can tell me a bit about growing up in as an Irish heritage a person as a millennial in the United Kingdom. Well, when did you feel most and least Irish?
I think for me, I mentioned the Six Nations. I think for me, the Six Nations was like the beginning of my journey into Irishness. I'm from Bedfordshire, which is like a quite rural, very sort of white British area.
Yeah.
And my mum was the only sort of like Irish person around. And it was very difficult for us to access like Irish news, or if you wanted to watch the GAA, like we had to travel for 30 minutes to go to a pub to watch the match or whatever was happening. Yeah. And so when we were watching the Six Nations, my family and like my friends' families would all get together and they'd watch Six Nations, and my mum would be the only Irish person. And so when it was Ireland versus England, she was sort of ganged up on as the only Irish person. And so then I, like, because of that, I was like, no, I support Ireland. Like, I'll take sides with my mum. And then, like, that led into, like, I'd run up and down the road with a tricolour round my back if Ireland beat England or... This is like when I was like 7, 8 years old, like sprinting up and down the road with my tricolour on and like knocking on the neighbours' doors because he was Welsh and Ireland had beat Wales. And I think that was like the beginning of my like expressing Irishness as like my dominant identity.
Yeah.
And that sort of led me down this big road. Like, I mean, we talk about passports, like I've always had an Irish passport and I've always felt that that's made me more Irish than British potentially, even though I sound the way I do and I was born the way where I was and that sort of stuff. So I think that was sort of it. And it's just got more and more. I feel like it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like as you identify as Irish, you then get made more Irish. So like, it's not even questioned anymore, particularly among like people I know. Like it's just, I wander around banging on about Irishness and doing PhDs on Irishness, and that's just who I am now. I think also like my name, like people can't pronounce it.
I was about to ask about how do your neighbours and peers handle Niamh?
It's got a lot better recently. I think Niamh has become much more popular in this country in the last 10 years. Like I was teaching in a school a couple of years ago, and there were 3 Niamhs in the year.
Oh.
All spelled N-I-A-M-H as opposed to like N-E-E-V-E or whatever.
Yes.
Other ways you can spell it. And like when I was at school, there was none. Like I knew no one. And so like it's definitely a bit more popular, a bit more common. But I just remember there'd always be, if there was like a substitute teacher doing the register, they'd be going through and then there'd just be a pause. And I'd just be like, yeah, I'm here, like it's me. Or I'd get like Naomi or Nina.
You get Naomi.
Yeah, no, that's the one that really used to get me. I'm like, I get where you get Niamh from. Where is Naomi? Like, you've not even tried.
Absolutely. That's a gas one. Because I think there has often been a tendency, and this comes on both sides, on one level too, to see an Irish name and to try and find the closest English equivalent. But that also goes both ways, and that sometimes when people with English names want to Irish it up, like Roger Casement, I think it was Rory McCosh, I suppose, and they changed Roger to Rory, and those names have no connection. Other than the fact they both begin with an R, and it's, sure, we'll have at it.
Why not?
Exactly. Yeah, so and I presume you still get this in if you are visiting a coffee establishments where people which have a tradition of writing their names on cups.
Yes, I get all sorts of fun things. I quite often just get Eve. Like sometimes, I even depending on whether I'm willing to have a conversation about it, mm-hmm. I'm like, I just say Eve because it's easier sometimes. Yeah. Which sounds so lazy, but there's just like if you're catching a 5 a.m. train, like there's just not the time. I just need my coffee. Like, I don't want to go into how you spell my name. And sometimes I get, because my surname is Lear, L-E-A-R,
yeah.
Sometimes I get that gets put as my first name and I get Leah.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, that's not even my name. Like, my breakdown cover came like that. And I was like, that's not my name. I have to call you back and change that one.
One of the fastest growing popular names in Ireland is Fia, which mm-hmm. there's two spellings, F-I-A-D-H and F-I-A. And I saw just in some baby naming forums and parenting forums, people talking about names they liked and why they liked this one. And some were saying, I like Fia as a name, but I'm just worried that if my my daughter goes to London, people are going to think it's Thea, but pronounced badly and phonetically.
Mm-hmm.
As in just the TH should be spelled that way. And people thought that the actual having the silent DH at the end almost kind of made it safer. That and also there wasn't an abbreviation of Sophia.
Yeah, yeah. I think also like I've always found it to be a really positive thing. Like I know that sounds bizarre, but it always like it's a good conversation starter. Like you're going into an interview or someone and someone's like, oh, I just want to check like how do you say your name?
Mm-hmm.
And then you automatically get into like a chat and like, oh well, this is my heritage, and it sort of breaks the ice.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't change it. I think a lot of people would see it as a negative thing, like people not being able to pronounce your name. But other than the 5 a.m. coffees, like I quite like it.
And you're right too, it's a great name. So, and when you did go over to visit Mayo and the cousins in Ireland, how did you find that your Irish identity was acknowledged or understood in Ireland?
Ireland is a weird place, like, in the sense that in many ways the diaspora is encouraged and, as you say, like, even when you talk about, like, citizenship and the fact that it's set up so that people of Irish ancestry can access their Irish citizenship and Irish passports.
Yes.
And then I would go over, and it's something that's been echoed by many of my participants who've said, like, that the people who are most likely to contest their Irishness are their Irish family.
Yes.
And not necessarily even in something that would seem malicious, but just in those little ways. Like, so, like, for me and my brother, out of our like group of cousins, we have other groups of cousins in the UK, but they've all got like two Irish parents, whereas I have a British father, and we'd be called the Brits. Mm. And it's like, why are we the Brits and the cousins from London aren't the Brits? Mm-hmm. Or I got called a tan, and I didn't even know what a tan was. Like, I was like, I'm not tan. I don't understand what you're banging on about. And I had to go and Google it. Because obviously we don't get taught about British colonialism in history in England.
What did you find when you Googled tans?
It took me a while to find like the black and tans and to actually like get down to it. Mm. But yeah, so I think it is something, it's a difficult one to negotiate. Like, one of my participants, she was at a wedding and the straw boys came.
Oh.
And she walked in and they were like, oh, you wouldn't understand this. You're not Irish. And she was like, I was like shocked because my whole life I'd been told I was Irish.
Mm.
And then here I was being told that I wasn't. And that sort of feeling of in-betweenness is really common. One of my participants once said to me, he's like, I feel like I'm the Isle of Man. Like, I'm just loitering in the middle. Like, you're not quite English enough and you're not quite Irish enough.
That's why the Pogues put the raft, the Medusa, on the cover of one of their albums, The Sodom, Sodomy and the Lash, was the idea of they're kind of, like, trapped halfway between two lands.
Yeah, I really relate to that. I think it's something that lots of people find, like, you no matter what you do, you can never be enough for either side. So you kind of have to just, I don't know, fully embrace it.
Yeah, and so this was when Dean Swift was writing Gulliver's Travels, the idea that Gulliver, when he was in Lilliput, felt, you know, kind of that he's too big to fit in. When he went to the next place and he was actually too small to fit in, mm-hmm. that this was his kind of experience of being Anglo-Irish. But obviously being Anglo-Irish is completely different from being of Irish heritage in Britain.
Yes, that's something I'm actually writing about at the moment, in the sense that it's much more acceptable to be like American-Irish. Hmm. Like that sort of a thing, and like, yeah, it's met with a lot of like eye rolls and whatever in some instances, but it's more recognized.
Yes.
Whereas in some ways Irishness as we know it today, particularly when you say, like, obviously a lot of the like visible indicators of Irishness are very much driven by the diaspora, and like celebrations of St. Patrick's Day and Irish dance in the GAA, a lot of that. And the popularity of that stemmed from trying to sustain Irishness in resistance to Englishness.
Yes.
And so when you're in the position where you're sort of, it's very difficult to be something, to be both of something, when one of them was generated in many ways to resist the other.
Yes.
And like, as I said, there's not even really a word for it. Like, what would you be? Because Anglo-Irish is not the same as being both English and Irish. So it's a bit of a weird little spot to be in, I guess.
It's part of the fact that maybe Irish Americans became a political lobby and became kind of an electoral force to be reckoned with, in a way that maybe Irish people haven't been an electoral force in the UK in the same way.
No, Irish people in the UK have been very much absorbed into Britishness, in the sense that they're a white population. There's a lot of work on the invisibility of Irishness within British society. I think part of that is potentially problematic because during the Troubles, were the Irish invisible in British society? You can question that, but on the whole, it was. I talk about it in the sense of like everyday colonialism. I think a lot of what goes on within the relationship between Ireland and the United Kingdom, specifically England, is like a colonial hangover. Even just the way that Ireland is spoken about sometimes by people in the British government is very derogatory. And like, oh, well, you know, we have to watch out for those Irish people, like as if the Irish don't have their own government. And I don't know, it's hard then negotiating that on a day-to-day basis, because it wasn't until 2011, for example, that white Irish was an option on the British census.
Really?
2011. I'm pretty sure that was the first one. It was either 2011 or 2001. Other than that, I'm sure it's 2011. You were white British or white other.
Oh.
So you couldn't even express that you were Irish in your ethnicity before then, which seems like madness, but that's the way it was. So in many ways within Britain, the Irish are sort of like absorbed in, other than like, oh, you know, they do their fun little Irish games and Irish pubs or whatever. And it's in some ways quite reductive of Irishness as an independent country, I guess.
And this is something that does happen, that Irishness is seen as almost a recreational identity.
Yeah.
In your research, did you come across the phenomenon of, I guess, Irish people maybe being actually seeing the news in England and in a way that doesn't go both ways, and that Irish people have, with conversations particularly around Brexit and particularly around those conversations where there was a possible disagreement between the two countries, that Irishness was spoken about in a way that by politicians who didn't realise that Irish people were listening?
I think it didn't like come up in my research in that way, mm-hmm. But it was expressed by my participants like a frustration with the fact that, like, David Davis who said you could spend pounds in Dublin. Like, you'd never say you could spend pounds in Paris.
Yeah.
Like, that wouldn't happen. And like a lot of people I spoke to, I think a lot of the reason why they felt more Irish after Brexit was in opposition to those sorts of dominant discourses that were coming out of the British government at the time. Because I do think, as you say, like, news like British news gets reported in Ireland much more than Irish news gets reported in Britain. I don't think people necessarily realise that it is reported as much as it is, and that there is such an understanding in Ireland. And there's huge ignorance in England, like just the amount of people who don't know that the Republic of Ireland isn't Southern Ireland.
Yes.
Like, it's not how it works.
I mean, a part of me reminds myself to be a little forgiving in the way that a lot of Irish people will be very sensitive about those kinds of remarks about saying Southern Ireland and Southern Republic. But they would refer to anyone from the Eastern European bloc countries as Poland or somewhere, or Polish. And they will refer to a lot of African countries that say, I think they're Nigerian or something. And they will lump a lot of countries together that they don't understand very well, and that we are guilty of it as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's a wider issue than just like Irish and English, obviously.
But it does at the same time, though. I mean, there's two countries right next to each other with a similar significant language and cultural overlaps.
Oh, but in such interrelated histories, I think as well. Like, I think that causes a lot of frustration within people that I've been speaking to. Like, it's just, I don't know, I think it makes them more defensive of their Irishness in a way.
Yeah, I can imagine so. And yeah, it would have to. Something that when you've, in your research, you identified maybe two groups of maybe two kind of large groups of passport applicants, maybe yeah. UK-born passport applicants. Do you want to tell me about those?
We talk in the ethnic apologists and pragmatic cosmopolitans. Yes. So this is not my idea. This is put forward by Woods and Gilmartin. But it's basically the idea that people applying for Irish passports after Brexit fall into these two broader categories. The pragmatic cosmopolitans, who are like, you know, I need freedom of movement. I want to be able to go work in France or Germany or Spain. Like, it's very based around European rights and holding on to those European rights, which obviously you can access by having Irish citizenship, because therefore you're then a European citizen.
Yeah.
And then there's the ethnic apologists, who are a bit like, oh, I am Irish. I've always been a bit Irish. You know, like, we went home for the summer and I like Tato and those sorts of things. And they're more apologetic about the fact that they're accessing their Irish passport. They're a bit more like, no, like, I am Irish, rather than I just need to be able to access European rights, which is a bit more like pragmatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's closer to the Americans who threaten to move to Canada every year.
Yes.
Oh, yes. There's a version of that everywhere. And then you did talk again in your research as well. These groups came up, and this is obviously something that you're not breaking new ground here. There's obviously, if there's a bit of research and that's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
How long is your bibliography?
Oh, I don't even know yet. I've just got like references all over the shop. I open new documents all the time. I'm like, oh, there's another list. Or just like my list of things to read gets longer every single day.
This is the thing. It becomes it's kind of almost viral. It's certainly exponential. The way the more research you do, the more you realize you got to do, and you're just doing a bit of research, and you think you're all through it, and then you see a book referenced in a book you're reading, and you think, God, he's referring to like 9 pages there. What's in those 9 pages? Like, I've got that book.
Or like, how have I missed that? And like, particularly like, obviously at the moment, we can't access the library, and I'm like. There's all this knowledge locked away somewhere that I'm like, oh, well, hope I don't need that.
It's given people kind of a tiny taste of what doing this kind of research was like in the old days, when you actually did physically have to travel to a different library to get a different book. And whereas now, I mean, in Ireland, we've got a phenomenal library service now, where if the book exists, you can order a book, any book that's in any library in Ireland, through its interlibrary loan system. And that it effectively will cover everything, as well as having all these audiobooks as well. But now, because of the COVID, that's been restricted. It's been a hell of a time for postgraduate students and just avid readers.
Yeah, or even like the library is great. Like Newcastle University Library, props to them, they're great. But there are some books that there just isn't a digital copy of. Like,
yeah.
especially when you get to this point where, like, I'm looking for really, really niche books. There isn't an ebook, and short of them buying the book and posting it out to me, which currently they're not able to do, I can't access it. And I mean, it does give me a greater appreciation for people who did PhDs before Google, because
yes,
it's not a world I want to be in.
No joke at all. But I'd say that back in those days, it was a trick. But at the same time, I suppose it was probably harder for people to check their bibliographies and see if they were valid as well.
True.
When we talk about kind of hierarchies of Irish identity, this is something I know that's my wife is from Northern Ireland, or the 4-4 bit of Ireland, as opposed to the 3-5-3 bit of Ireland, because, you know, there's so many contested ways of saying whether it's north of Ireland, Northern Ireland, occupied counties, so forth, and hard to strike a balance sometimes. And
yeah, very inflammatory language sometimes.
It can be very inflammatory, even when you think you're being neutral. I found that the mobile phone kind of international codes is the safest way to do it.
You can't really deny that.
Yeah, it seems as relatively neutral, but she would have her Irishness contested in Dublin quite frequently and be referred to as a Brit. And have these things, and sometimes you get, it's a very frustrating thing to experience. But then there are certain things where, like, Irish people would have kind of a shared experience, maybe watching the Late Late Toy Show, the Rose of Tralee, and things like these things. And when a lot of adults appreciate those things ironically or semi-ironically, because she didn't grow up watching those, she just sees them as bad TV.
Rose of Tralee was the highlight of my summer, let me tell you.
Did you ever play?
I did not. I dreamed of it, but I couldn't think of a skill.
Oh, because especially now you can't read a poem anymore.
Yeah, no, and I have no, I'm not musically gifted. I don't dance. Like, I don't have a skill.
It was very funny. A couple of years ago, one of the Sydney Rose, Brianna Parkins, went on to become a guest on this very show, as well as working on Ireland AM. She spoke out about one of the referendums, we're having the referendum of the Eighth Amendment. And a few people said, well, why should we have like a Rose of Tralee, you know, speaking these things? Why can't they just, you know, do a bit of Irish dancing and get lost? And someone made the really interesting point that the concentration of educational qualifications and life skills in the Rose applicants was higher than the concentration in our parliament in terms of the amount of people doing kind of of Rose's doing postgraduate research or different work among in different spheres and language speaking, all those other skills was very, very high, but it was dismissed.
I suppose that brings you back to, I mean, I don't want to get into like big feminist issues, but
I go on.
It brings you back to like women should be seen and not heard, doesn't it? Like, because in a lot of ways, the Rose of Tralee is a traditional sort of who is the fairest of them all competition.
It is
not necessarily given space for...
Yeah, not given space. And I think one journalist described it as Patrick Frayne, who writes the Irish Times, he described it as rather being kind of a measure of beauty. It's a measure of kind of daughter-in-law-ishness.
Yeah, I can see that.
And so, yeah, it's still kind of a very, kind of, it's a particular kind of male gaze or parental gaze, as opposed to maybe just a traditional beauty contest or a different type of gaze.
Yeah.
And because, it may always make clear it wasn't just a beauty contest, but it was kind of a parent and present contest. Almost.
Yeah, it's very like, what is palatable? Like, not necessarily here to hear all of my big opinions and get into big debates. Exactly. Which, to be fair, I probably wouldn't have been very good on it. I wouldn't have done well. So maybe that's a good thing. I never realised that dream.
Good stuff. So what other kind of experiences of, I mean, when what other kind of access? You mentioned GAA and Six Nations. What other kind of moments of Irishness did you get to appreciate growing up in Bedfordshire?
Me myself.
Yeah, did you have the Irish goods aisle with tatoes in them and things like that?
No, not for a very long time. That's only a sort of recent phenomenon. I remember my mum going out to the shop and coming back being like, "What a dream! What a dream! I can get emerald toffees in Morrison's now."
Wow.
I keep saying Morrison's. It's just that happened to be the supermarket that sells Emerald Toffees over here.
you're not just advertising Morrison's here.
No, I'm not. We had very little access to that. Like, my experience was very much like goods smuggled over in a suitcase from the home country. Which is a lot of people I spoke to had the same thing. Like, your granny would come over with like suitcases packed full of YR sauce and Tato crisps, like the Republic of Ireland Tato crisps, because we can get Tato crisps in this country.
But they're the 44 Tato.
Yeah.
We sometimes refer to the 353 Tato as the Free Stato.
The Free Stato. I got a delivery from the Tyneside Irish Centre last week I got like Glenlock Gin and Tato, Sidona, Club, you know, the classics.
Oh, yes.
And I put a picture up on my social media and my cousin was like, "That's not real Tato." I'm like, it's really difficult. It's really difficult to get Free Stato in this country, particularly at the moment because Tato have stopped shipping.
Yes.
And my mum is usually my biggest supplier, and obviously she's not hopping over as often as she is currently. So no, we didn't have a lot of that.
Because I know Noel Gallagher was talking about his visits to Ireland as a child, and he loved Silverman's. But he also mentioned, I'm fairly sure he mentioned brunches. And I was like, do Wall's ice cream not do brunch in the UK?
What, the
brunch being the ice cream with the kind of weird yellow and red crumbs on it.
No, that's not a thing. And you very rarely see, you know, the not tubs of ice cream, they're like the ones that you slice.
Oh, like Viennetta's?
No. We have that, but you know, like just the plain vanilla ice cream that comes like wrapped in cardboard that you slice and you put between the wafers, like an ice cream sandwich.
Hazelbrook Farm, the HB kind of classic, kind of just block of ice cream.
Yeah.
Yes.
You don't find that very often. And if anyone listening knows where you do find it, please hit me up, because that is the taste of summer, is like ice cream sandwiches.
Oh, God, ice cream sandwiches between two wafers. You know,
delicious. And like you just... it's not the same if you have to like scoop it out of a tub and make it into a shape. It's not. Yeah, it becomes a lot more admin.
I know that I was talking to the lad who runs Murphy's Ice Cream, which is run out of Dingle, but they have a few outlets around. And he said that they did a sea salt flavored ice cream. And he said, some people saying, "Well, who has that?" And he says, "Don't you just love in your summer holidays when you're eating an ice cream sandwich and you can taste the sea? You've just had a swim and there's a little bit of salt on your lips and that. You wonder why the ice cream tastes so good after a swim. That's what I tried to capture."
Oh my God, that sounds so cool.
It really does. Because sometimes I think that you can taste a little bit of suntan lotion as well, but you probably can't put that in an ice cream.
No, that probably wouldn't go down as well, would it?
Maybe not. So I'm sure there's another part of your research which we haven't... What was the biggest surprise, I suppose, when you were in your research and on Irish identity?
I think, for me, it was... we touched on the hierarchies of Irishness earlier, and I think, for me, that was the biggest thing. Like, that, in the sense... So when I talk about hierarchies, I guess... I've sort of conceptualised it as like you have the proper Paddies, people who haven't left, they're truly Irish, they're committed to the Irish state and living their best lives. And then you have the expat Paddies who sort of like jump ship, but they're still Irish. And then I'm sure most people will have heard about the plastic Paddies, people like me, who are inauthentically Irish to some. Mm. And then... Like, that I was really familiar with. Like, that's my experience. I know that. I understand that. I've been called plastic. I've been called tan. I've been called Brit. I've had all of that. But then, like, this like, post-Brexit sort of thing where people are now trying to separate themselves from the new influx of Irish citizens who are accessing Irish citizenship after Brexit, who potentially have the same heritage as people who have had their Irish passport for a lot longer... but who, like, so the plastic Paddies are now like redrawing the boundaries of Irishness so that they are separating themselves from this new wave and in authenticating the claims of these people to Irishness, probably because like they've had their the authenticity of their identity questioned and contested over and over and over and over again. And like, people do find that frustrating. And then obviously, as we've said, like when that is then reported in Irish newspapers, of like people jump in for Irish citizenship and as if it's like really easy, like you just pop down to the shop for a packet of crisps and an Irish passport. Like it, that then inauthenticates people who've always had Irish citizenship and they're trying to distinguish themselves from that. And I think that is really interesting to me because they're essentially policing Irishness in the same way as they've had their Irishness policed and has been really problematic for them.
Absolutely.
Or even just the amount of people who've said, like, since Brexit, when they're queuing to get off a Ryanair plane in, I don't know, on their holiday to Corfu or wherever they're going, and they're holding their Irish passport facing outwards so that people don't see that. So they're like, I am Irish, not British. Like really, really trying to distance themselves from the sort of British exceptionalism that, that Brexit has come to represent. And I think that was really interesting for me.
That was extraordinary. Did you find, I'm not sure if this fell within your remit, but like when you consider, say, the Greek community in London, or some of the third or fourth generation Italian community in Glasgow, or some of the other kind of migrant communities in the United Kingdom, they have a similar experience to this? Or has there been like a Russian, like, you know, Greek passports or Italian passports? Or I know some people, I've seen some of my Facebook friends sharing pictures of the new passport they got since Brexit. But is Irish unique or unusual or singular or even unique in this regard?
I don't know like a huge amount about the others. Like I say, it's not. I've researched specifically Irish, but I think the Irish is a bigger thing because of the way Irish citizenship law prioritizes descent.
Yeah.
And because of the fact, like, there's so many people in this country who have an Irish grandparent. Like, there's, because obviously, as I said earlier, like the census data and stuff, like that, we don't have proper statistics on how many Irish are in England.
Yeah.
It's hard to say exactly what numbers, but so many people have an Irish granny. Like,
yeah.
And so therefore so many people are entitled to it. Like, people who are in my life regularly who are suddenly like, oh yeah, well, my grandma's Irish. And I'm like, how did I not know that? Because it's just not something that they ever really explored. Like, they didn't go back to Ireland and they didn't necessarily engage with it beforehand. I think it's just the sheer number of, like, I think it was like a 69% increase the year after. So 2017, I think there's a 69% increase in passport applications just from Great Britain, like not Northern Ireland, Great Britain alone.
Yeah.
Which is an insane amount. And I think that's why the rhetoric is so strong around it. Whereas not so much around like Italian or Greek or the other migrant communities.
That is interesting. All right, and now I suppose that, like, now the fact that Irish people who are ordinarily resident in the UK can actually vote in a way maybe that other EU citizens can't in the United Kingdom, do you see that becoming a material issue in the future? I mean the fact that Irish people haven't been maybe a singular political voice in the way maybe they were in the United States, is it likely or possible that there's the concentration is in a few areas could swing a vote?
I don't know.
Probably not. No.
I don't think so. I think I'd like to think so. I think Brexit, as that particular referendum, it sort of went past party lines in many, many ways, and I don't necessarily see that would transpire to like regular everyday politics in this country. But sure, like, who knows? As a left-leaning Remain voter myself, I would hope so. but like, because there is a huge, like, so many people I spoke to, I was like, well, like, why are you so keen to access an Irish passport or your Irish citizenship? And they're like, because I hate Boris Johnson. like, genuinely, that was response. And I, like, the voices of Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage and that sort of very imperial, white, male sort of Britishness, that is very indicative of Brexit. People don't want to be associated with it. And so in a lot of ways, I don't think it's necessarily people wanting to be more Irish. I think it's that they don't feel any connection to that sort of Britishness anymore. And that is how Britishness is seen currently, and that doesn't relate to them.
What really gets me is I can't believe how young those two men are. I mean, they were both born in 1964. They're both the same age as Keanu Reeves and Lenny Kravitz and Alec Ferson.
Uh-huh.
And so they would have been 20 when Live Aid happened. And, like, it's just... So, and you generally think people with a lot of these kind of old-fashioned views would be very, very old, but they're not that old. And
nope. They've had
them, you know? And so often people defend kind of some conservative views, saying, yeah, sure, that's how you get when you get older. But, like, they've always been like this.
Yeah, they're not old.
and you know, then a lot of things happened, and you know, the opinion forming things happening in their lifetime, they took the wrong opinion.
No, I like that it's, do you know, like, British colonialism is hugely problematic in so many ways, obviously. And like, as you say, people who are older do sort of get a bit like, oh well, you know, it's what they know. That's not what these people know. It's what's being peddled currently. And I think it has led to, I mean, watch me get absolutely crucified for these comments now, but I think it has led to a normalization of pretty problematic views of immigration and of migrant identities and of women and just minorities in general in our society. And like, people, a lot of people who are now, particularly because I'm researching particularly like the millennial second generation, so people who are sort of 35 and under, who would be seen as the post Troubles generation.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I personally don't think that there's such a thing as a post Troubles generation of Irishness, because I think the Troubles and how they came to be are so ingrained into Anglo-Irish relations.
Yes.
That I don't think you can, like, I get called a tan. Do you know, like, I don't think you can have a post-Troubles.
I do think there's two waves of this, because I'm a little bit older than you in that I suppose I was able to, old enough to vote in the Good Friday Agreement referendum.
Yeah.
And I do remember, just even from being in college then, how the wave of Irish pop music, that new friendly face of Irishness, like the Corrs and Westlife and Boyzone, all happened around that time. And there was a cultural wave that representations of Irishness suddenly became kind of cuter, friendlier. There was a little bit, it was... The like 10 years earlier, the idea of an English girl having a poster of an Irishman on her wall,
it was radical.
Yeah, well, it certainly was a little bit ridiculous, and maybe he could be a little bit scary. And that's kind of that happened very quickly. And then you would have had Bewitched, the idea of you would have had Irish music beforehand in the pop charts from like Clannad and Enya, which, you know, the idea was it was still seen as mysterious. It wasn't, whereas Bewitched were being presented as more relatable best friends. There was a different representation of how Irishness was expressed. And then as time has gone on, and then people who fast forward 15, 16 years, and people who don't remember as many while the Troubles were still existing and there was still intransigence in Northern Ireland, you didn't have the daily reports of deaths and things on the news. Wasn't the first item of the news wasn't always a tragedy in the north.
Yeah, no, I think I was born in 1993. I don't remember it. Mm-hmm. And obviously I don't think the way I've experienced Irishness is in any way similar to that of people who migrated even in the 1980s, or like my mother, like the way she experienced it.
Yeah.
Partly because I don't speak with an Irish accent. I'm an invisible sort of Irish person.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think within academic literature, there's sort of an argument of like, oh, for these people, it doesn't even matter that the Troubles existed. And I don't think that is the case. Like, as you say, like, yes, culture around Irishness, and Irishness is, especially now, like Irishness at the moment is cool. Like, in this country, like, as I say, everyone wants an Irish granny. Like, the clear, like, winner of lockdown, if there is one, is normal people. And, and like, in that way, like, Irishness is sort of on the agenda. But I don't buy that there's any generation of Irish migrant, particularly like right now, that isn't impacted in some way by the relationship between Ireland and England. Like, I just don't think you can get away from that.
I think you're dead right there. It's something, yeah, that the past isn't even past, as William Faulkner would say.
Yeah, it's all inherited. Like, we inherit the perspectives of the people above us, and history reproduces itself in many different ways.
That's right. As we have seen, you can push a statue into a river or into the sea, but it's still bubbling under there. You can't push the entire legacy, though. But
it still happened.
Before we get to the end, I have to ask your perspective on the current statue pushing trend.
Yeah, I mean, fair play, you know.
It does seem fun, even if the statue is of a fairly neutral person. You get a part of me thinks it must be fun to push a statue into the sea.
It is. It sounds terrible, but I was like, oh God, I hope there's no boats going around there at the moment. I'm like, someone's going to get a really expensive hole in the hull of their boat, which obviously is not the big issue here. Mm. But no, I think it's just a representation, like people not being listened to. Like,
yeah.
And I really don't buy, you see on I don't know, like on Twitter and stuff at the moment, people being like, oh, statues are education. I'm like, I have never learned anything from a statue, ever. Yeah. I was in, I think it was in Budapest, and this could be me completely speaking wrongly. And they have like a park that has all the old, Iron Curtain sort of statues that all got ripped down with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And they have them in a park, and they're all there and you can learn about them. And I think that is much more useful than leaving it up as a memorial to something, as if it's something in a place that people go to in their day-to-day lives, because people aren't looking at them. And I don't buy this argument of let's leave up these statues of people who made their money and their influence from the slave trade because it's educating people. It's not. Like, if you put it in a park or somewhere that people go to in order to learn, that's different. Yeah. But they're there being celebrated, and I think that's... like, surely we're progressing a little bit now.
I'd like to think so. And a big thing is, because I was thinking recently about it in Dublin, I suppose. We don't have that many statues. We have some, but the big thing is, obviously, there's some street names. And the fact, say, the streets like Westmoreland Street and Mountjoy Square, and most people don't know who those are named after. And if they took an investigation, they might say, well, you know, maybe that's not necessarily someone whose views are closely aligned to our modern values. But they built Dublin City Council built a new bridge a couple of years ago, and they named it after Rosie Hackett, who was a union activist. And the discussion around getting who's the bridge should be named after did lead to a lot of public engagement with history. And it led to an engagement, led to articles about who this person was, led to people saying, well, I think it should be about this person. And the level of engagement about naming something new was very valuable. But once, I guess, 200 years later, the significance, Westmoreland is just a name people say without thinking.
Yeah. No, we had a similar thing with the pictures on the new notes. Like,
oh, yes.
Whose images should be on the new, like, £5 note, £10 note, £20 note. And I think like that's a much more active way of engaging a population in history and who someone is. Because as you said, like, I had no idea what the name of the man who was on the £5 note was. Why would I? I just spent it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I haven't got enough fivers.
I was just absolutely buzzing to get a fiver when I was 10, you know?
Oh, God, yeah. That completely. And,
much money.
And I think it's just that after the Civil War in Ireland, there was, I guess, tensions were so high that they made a decision not to put politicians' faces on money, and before the euro we would have had Queen Maeve on the £1 note, and there was I think they changed them in the 90s as well, but they would have had various other figures. Yeats was on a 20, I think, and James Joyce was on one of them as well. I didn't have enough myself, but there is a possibility of actually using, but statues are still different, because naming a street is one thing, but like a statue is being presented, the very fact that you're sculpting, you're putting the person there, you're putting them quite larger than life. You're expecting people to look at them and go, wow, this person is impressive. You see their face.
Yeah, it's definitely like it's a memorialization in like a positive way. Like, people don't get statues put up being like, this was a terribly bad person, let's put a statue up.
Yeah, or let's consider the pros and cons of this person's of a legacy.
Yeah.
Never.
No. And so that's, I don't know. I think fair play to the people who are going and ripping them down. Safely, preferably.
Yes, absolutely. You always remember your manual handling training when you're pushing a statue.
Exactly. Make sure you're bending your knees before you lift.
Exactly. And yeah, and make sure there's no little fishies and frog and tadpoles under the water where you're pushing them to.
Has Cromwell been? No, Christopher Columbus has been moved now, hasn't he?
I think so.
I think I saw that on Twitter before I came on this call. I haven't researched, but I think he's in a pond in Richmond now.
Because I know in Belgium, the Leopold, who, you know,
yes,
had very little to recommend him. And we actually have, we discussed him recently in a show at Belgium. He's been given a bath as well.
Given his marching orders.
Absolutely. Niamh, before we let you go, we love to ask all our guests what their favourite Irish word is.
Yes. I have a really, really boring one. So, my experience of Irishness in Ireland is very much connected to Ryanair planes and landing in either Dublin or Knock Airport. Shout out to Knock Airport, what legends.
Oh, yes.
And for me, I think it's probably Fáilte, because that was me being home, and that meant that, like, I don't know, like, back in the day, you come out of Dublin Airport and out of the arrivals gate, you'd hang a straight left and you could get hold of your club and your tato.
Yeah.
And get your Irish soda bread and vegetable soup, which is my number one most favourite meal in the world. So, yeah, Fáilte.
Fantastic. Niamh, where can people get in touch with you and find out more about your research?
Twitter. My handle is just Niamh Lear, one word, straight. And there, my pinned tweet at the moment is a presentation I did for the British Association of Irish Studies conference. And if you go onto their Twitter, there's some really, really amazing Irish research that's being done by people in Britain right now. And you should go give it a watch, because it's all really good.
Fantastic. And we will put those links in the show notes as well.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully I'll be back soon, because that's just fantastic. We barely touched the surface.
Always willing to have a chat.
Great stuff. So until the next time, it's Islam from me. Mind yourselves. Bye. That's our episode for this week. Thank you so much, Niamh Lear, for being such a brilliant guest. Mother Folklore comes out every Friday on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. If you can't wait that long for your next podcast fix, there are other shows on the Head Stuff Podcast Network, such as Pints of Malt, which goes into the experiences of growing up Nigerian and Irish in Ireland. It's well worth checking out. If you want to contact the show, the Mother Folklore Show, you can contact us at motherfolklore@headstuff.org. Brian is our producer. Kirsten Shield does our art. If you want to record your own podcast, you can contact Headstuff and the podcast studios. The details are in our show notes. And as we said at the top of the episode, the continued production of Mother Folklore is made possible by the very generous support on Patreon of certain listeners, who also will be able to access bonus content if you want to join them. The link is in our show notes to Patreon. Until the next time, slán go fóill.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Please.